Oh, hey.
What's the story, morning glory? It was the tale, Nightingale. Have you heard about Hugo and Kim? Hi.
Wow. Here we are.
Ryan, I think I have an ague.
Of what?
I think I have a fever. Feeling good, Ryan. I've been sick. I've been sick. I feel like everybody's getting a little spring flu. You were supposed to be in my apartment today, but I warned you, and so you didn't come, which is smart because you're not breathing in the miasma of my ague.
Do you often use bigger words when you're sick?
I only use large.
Must have a minimum of four syllables.
Well, so what happens is like my brain turns to jelly, so I have to access the attic where I keep garbage,
Sure,
large
yes.
words. That's where we're going.
That's where we're going. Lots has happened since the last we spoke. Not the least of which is the furthering of the and don't worry, the whole episode will not be about this. The furthering of the Kino Allo Cody
They're all
lions and
such,
tigers
they're
and
all
bears. Oh my.
such. It's just garbage. I'm sorry. I can't, like, I was, to be fair, I watched the video response or the video interview with Waylon and Kino.
Yes.
And they kept, both of them kept trying to be like, and if we could just come to this in the spirit of yoga. It made me want to cut myself. And I can make that joke because I was a teenager self-injurer. So if anybody's writing an angry email right now about making light of SI, I'm allowed to. But I really wanted to end it. I thought it was the most condescending thing in the world.
Also, I like this is for, people who are getting sued and don't have a lot of money. Like I want to recognize the fact that that is a huge, huge deal and really shitty.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
However, comparing
Oh my
this
God, that's right.
to, conversations around civil rights and
The Holocaust? Yeah.
Yes, and Gandhi, I
Now,
think,
flag on the field. Flag on the field.
yeah, I just, I don't know. It's a tactic. I'm not sure that it is really a tactic that's going to get you very far. And yeah, I think the GoFundMe page is fine. Like, I think all of it, like if people want to help Dana pay for legal, like that's all great. That's wonderful. If I had money, I would give some. But I to I don't know. To this is not meant to sound like, oh, poor Allo or poor Cody, 'cause no. But at the same time, it's just like this is only going to get resolved through legal
Yeah. Like once you get to the point
recourses, like.
where you're in that world, be in that world.
Yeah.
Don't then try to pull it back into saccharine pseudo spiritual yoga jargon. If we could just let go of ego and, embrace forgiveness and kindness. If we could, what did they kept saying? If we could meet on the field?
Lift each other up.
Oh. There's meat on the field and lift each other up. Teachers lifting other teachers up. That smacks of Christian rhetoric, first of all.
Yeah. I just... I don't really know. The whole thing just makes my stomach turn, and I've for many reasons, and I've had a lot of friends just sort of be like, oh, I can't even handle it, and like just sort of turn it off. And you know, that's what I've been doing whenever it's popped up on my Instagram. But it's also like, if that's the loudest voice, doesn't sit well with me.
No, it really doesn't. It's embarrassing. I mean, I think it's like if any other group of people were to like eavesdrop on this conversation, they'd be like, oh Jesus, they're in their adolescence, huh?
Yeah.
And I think that's the bummer for me, is like, this is our best and brightest. Shit. Yeah. And to be clear, I completely support Dana. If I had money, I'd throw her some. I am now even more passionate about who I give my money to. That's a company. Yeah. I am more energized and fervent about photography strategy for yoga teachers.
Yeah.
And ambassadorships and where we ally ourselves mm-hmm. with corporations. Like, yes, yeah. If anything good has come out of this for me personally, it's a sharpening of that particular knife in my drawer. But I find the whole thing to be a little clumsy, and I find Waylon to be weirdly self-important about this. He's like, well, here at Elephant, we're being very delicate. We're playing the role really of no, you're not. Nobody reads Elephant Journal anymore. And also, it's all clickbait. So yeah. Let's not pretend like you're the, this is the platform for like yeah. upper level discourse.
Yeah. I think what you pointed to as like a positive side is like, there have been a number of times where I've, you know, paused and been like, oh wait, do I really know? Like, is my perception of this company in, you know, the yoga world, any company that you have to interact with as a teacher or a yoga studio owner, like, is that accurate? Like, to just do a little do just a little bit more digging to check things out, to really see who you're going to support with your money, because you're supporting these companies and doing whatever it is they're doing. So if that is what could potentially come out of this whole mess, then that's fantastic, I think. Because we can't like turn off capitalism overnight. it doesn't work like that. Like, we're still gonna have to buy shit sometimes. So to be just really, really clear about what exactly you're supporting by buying a particular clothing brand or by buying props from this person or that person, you know, is the only potential positive thing that I could see come out of this whole mess.
Also, side note from an anonymous source who I know listens from time to time. I heard that Manduka is reaching out to their ambassadors to go into studios and demo their mats and show people how to care for them and clean them. And by people, I mean show teachers.
Like, as in ask teachers to go in and
yes.
practice on their mats?
I don't know if practice was, like, a big part of it, but it definitely was about, like, upkeep and cleaning of the mats.
It seems a strange strategy. You just clean the mat. Is it a mystery?
I mean,
Tell me if it is. If I'm like, I don't want to like, I clean my mat sometimes. That's all.
I just don't understand. I mean, I think that's better though, still than the Lululemon, but ambassadorship.
Yeah.
I just need to sit with this for a minute because my energy is really agued, and there's a lot to be apathetic about. And Ryan,
That should be the tagline for the podcast from now on. Unrolled Podcast, there's a
a
lot to be
lot to be
apathetic
apathetic
about.
about. I like that. Here's the thing, Ryan, because we're in a sea of garbage, because we're in a sea of garbage, there's so much easy, low-hanging fruit opportunity to be better.
Sure.
To collectively pick each other up. I'm sorry, kidding. No, but there's a chance, A, for new teachers to come in and do something new. And for us, as a group to do better. So that's the upside of this. I guess I just am bummed because it's like after 3 years of these conversations, what shifted?
Oh, I don't know.
And by
That's a
the way,
depressing thought.
Stormy Daniels is fucking awesome.
I was like, just it was so short.
I know, but she was so concise and clear
Yeah.
and honest, and I think it's interesting that she made multiple times the point that it was consensual, and yet as she was describing it, what she was describing to me wasn't necessarily something that wasn't consensual, but it certainly smacked of somebody that almost on some level psychologically lacked the agency to say otherwise. And yet she has so much agency. She's leveraged it to make a living out of it. But
Yeah.
systemically, the things that brought her to that were don't appear to be things that she chose. So I thought that was interesting that she was adamant about, and I think not mixing her in with the Me Too movement was important for her to stay clear of that so that everything she was saying couldn't potentially be construed as hyperbole, because then she'll be taken more seriously if she's as almost reductionist as possible in a fucked up way. You know what I
Yeah.
mean? I don't know. Sidetrack. So yeah, the other thing I've been thinking of this week was the Jay Brown podcast with Anna.
Sure, with Anna Forrest.
Yeah. Had some big feelings
And
about that one too. I had real big feelings.
you had big feelings?
I did.
Would you care to share them?
It's hard because I want to talk about them, but I also acknowledge the fact that I've met her multiple times. I've taken her workshop multiple times. I introduced her when she came to the Booksmith, for the release of Fierce Medicine in paperback, I did her introduction. And when I started practicing yoga, I sort of the first quote unquote style I was genuinely drawn to was Forrest. I hold Forrest in high regard. I hold Anna in high regard. And yet all of those things can be true, and I can also be like confused.
Yeah.
And uneasy about some of the things that are going on that were presented on that podcast, but also that in retrospect I observe as a stranger from the outside looking in on the somewhat public life of Anna Forrest.
Yeah. I have very little that I can say on this podcast on this topic.
Oh, Jesus. Well,
because you
don't want to piss anyone off?
I too am grateful that Forrest Yoga was around in Boston, because had it not been when I moved to Boston, I probably wouldn't have found very many places that I could practice, because it just simply moved at a pace that wasn't overstimulating for me. So like, as I was still finding my way to Barbara's classes, like it was the thing that sustained me through that like first year of grad school. Now, mind you, there were certain parts of the practice that I just wouldn't do. Like, I would maybe not do like half of the abdominal exercises. But I also honestly credit that more to the teachers who were teaching it. Like, I credit that more to Peter and to Lynn and to Nicole than to Anna. Certainly, Anna was a big influence on them to this day. Good, bad, and otherwise. I'm grateful that there are some really amazing teachers who don't teach Forrest Yoga, who have been through those intensive training programs and come out really skilled, caring, wonderful teachers. And at the same time, it was really difficult to listen to that. So, as a couple of different aspects of the podcast, but particularly the conversation around touch, and also the dynamic between the two of them, I found difficult. And I don't want to in any way judge the relationship they have, because it seems like they quite enjoy each other, and Forrest Yoga does seem to be flourishing, especially over in Australia and New Zealand. It's rare that I have to like stop Jay's podcast and just be like, no, I'm gonna listen to the rest of this later. I can't really say much more on that subject. So there you have it.
Okay, well then I'll say what I feel comfortable saying.
Cool.
Which is probably not that much more, but I find, and this is not unique to Anna, this is also observable in somebody like Sadie.
Sure.
And mind you, I don't have a personal relationship with these people. I don't know. I just know what I see from the outside, what's presented to the public. But it's interesting to me. It feels as if Jose came out of freaking left field and completely hijacked Forrest Yoga. You know, and that might be really unfair of me to say, but that's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. And that's what it sounded like. I thought he was not gracious or spacious. The guest on the show was Anna, and he was riding that pony hot and heavy. And I thought that he was diminutive to her at times, like when he was saying what he came in and what she needed I thought it was a little strange. And I don't like seeing people give up their power to a significant other that has come into their business. I'm always suspicious of that.
Yeah.
Now, is that what's happening? Not necessarily. Who the hell am I to know? That's not my business. I am literally just basing this, to be clear, on what I heard in the podcast.
Yeah.
So if somebody heard that and is offended, I can only comment on what I recognize the fact that I don't know.
Yeah.
But that in general, we're all influenced by the people in our lives.
Yeah.
We're all influenced by partnerships and friendships, and life changes and transitions. So I certainly don't think Anna might be kept in a vacuum or that would even be preferable. I certainly don't think that. But I do wonder sometimes when and if there are moments of fear that you don't want to do it on your own anymore, or something is somehow lacking that you're willing to give up, and what is being let go of to make space for something else, and why did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, those are answers to that we don't have.
Yeah.
But from the outside, I wonder if there is part of it that is like, on some deeper level, like just not trusting what you have, you know. I know that I have an impulse, and so this might speak actually more to me, you know, because like we always, when we don't have all the information, we extrapolate based on our own experience, and that's flawed. But I know for me that sometimes when I have a knee-jerk gesture, a knee-jerk reaction to collaborate, sometimes it's awesome and that collaboration is powerful and one enhances the other. And sometimes there's an urge to collaborate because you just don't want to bear it all on your own.
Yeah.
So I wonder how much of it is one and how much of it is the other. I have a friend who shall remain nameless, but also sometimes listens to the podcast. And she is always like, I want to collaborate with this expert and that expert, and I'm always saying, why? You're more than enough of on your, you know, on your own. I don't know. It's easy on the outside to point and say, no, do it, just own it. And then there's also beauty in sharing and having something evolve via influence.
Yeah, but you know, I think co-teaching can be, or co-creating or co-whatever, is like I've been to workshops with Angela and Victor where it was just like the two of them just speaking over each other at all times. Like there was very little collaboration, but then I've also been to workshops with another workshop with both of them where it was like totally seamless. So it's like, even when you're that close, or maybe even especially when you're that close with somebody, you know, that's tricky. You're stepping into some shit there.
Well, I just remember I took a workshop, and I have no problem talking a little smack about this, but I took a workshop with Sadie, and it was supposed to be a Sadie workshop, and she brought her boyfriend at the time, who ended up teaching like 80% of it.
Yeah, that does seem to be a pattern in yoga.
And I was like, hey, man, I paid for this experience. You know, I don't know. Yeah. I was work study. I don't know that I paid, but I was like, I theoretically paid for you, and now this guy is climbing all over everybody's mats.
Yeah.
And putting his hands on people. And I think it's hugely problematic.
Yeah.
You know, I got to be honest. I took a workshop with somebody else. I don't know if I should say their name. It's not super important. But I took a workshop with a famous senior yoga teacher, dude fella. Who had brought with him a league of assistants who were all over the place.
Yeah.
And what the why?
Yeah.
He didn't know where what they were, their adjustments were, what they were doing. It was so, and I happened to be on the mat next to, you know, like a 22-year-old little Barbie who caught the attention of one of the assistants who was all over her, and it was making me uncomfortable. And after class, she was like, "What the hell was that?" I was like, "He was creeping on you." And she's like, "Thank God you saw."
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, no. I've enjoyed assisting people, but I've always found it to be like really challenging, and there's like almost no way to not be a disturbance. Maybe not to the degree that you're talking about, hopefully not to the degree that you're talking about in that situation, but like it's just awkward because like you don't know where they're going, so in order to use my hands to like help support someone, and then if the teacher like takes a 180 to go down a different direction, then I'm like, yep. Oh crap, okay, that's not where we're going.
I know. And then you're having like a one-on-one with someone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that sometimes that's fine, and like depending on the context of the workshop, of course, that Angela and Victor workshop that I was talking about, there was like a whole half hour of the workshop where Victor just like pulled my mat to the other side of the room and was working with me on something. You know, so there's a way to do that well. But I think it depends on the context of the workshop. If someone's taking the group through a even moderate paced flow, like there's just very little you can do to get in there and get out of there without being disturbing. Cause then all of a sudden that person has to, the person on the mat has to process the instructions of the teacher and the hands of the assistant and not fall over. And that's a lot of information to process, especially if you're in any way uncomfortable about being assisted.
Yeah, you're totally right. I think it's a clusterfuck.
So the answer there is just don't teach so many goddamn people.
So the other thing I just remember, so you remember this, when I was in terrible back pain for a while. A sequestered disc.
That's when
the fluid it goes past bulging and it actually is a tear and it leaves the disc and then sits on the nerve.
Yeah.
So I was in rough shape, and I was taking a forest yoga workshop, and we were doing something that was aggravating my back. So I went into child's pose, and one of her assistants came over and was like, "That might feel good, but it's not good for your back." And I looked at her and I was like, "How the fuck do you know what's good for my back?
Yeah.
Did you have access to my MRIs?" And so then she's,
"Are you inside the lower curve of my spine right now? Dude."
Yeah, I'll tell you, you are not inside my body right now. And so she was coming over and trying to have me. She started doing some core work with me to heal my back, and I knew all about that, you know, because I'd been practicing forest for years, so I knew the forest core routine for back pain. And like she just kept telling me that my instincts were wrong.
Yeah.
And she was staying with me, like really staying with me. And I like appreciated the attention. That was nice. But I also was like, just leave me alone. I'm in pain. And then Anna saw all of this happening and came over and called her off.
Yeah.
And actually ended up working with me one-on-one. And it was lovely.
Yeah.
And she actually was like, "Yeah, what you are doing is right." So.
Yeah.
Well, that's what, Maybe you try this too.
It's never... Like, I was having a conversation with a student
yesterday. It might have been 2 days ago. I can't remember. But I asked them if there was another way that they could to do a different transition than how they were getting from one standing pose to another. And then there was a conversation that arose about sort of a tendon dysfunction in her hip, that the reason why she was moving in that particular way was to avoid the snapping of the tendon. And you know, because it wasn't in a group class, because it was, you know, an individual conversation, we were able to be like, oh, okay, so your instinct was absolutely right if we're just considering the front hip. But if we look at the whole, is there another way to make enough space in that, in the front of that hip, so that you can make the transition without making it so complicated on your back leg? And it wasn't that her instincts were wrong. It was her instincts were absolutely right. She felt that there was a jam happening in her front hip, and therefore she moved away from the front hip in order to make more room, and then made the transition. It, you know, I've seen so many assistants in situations like this just go over and tell people that they're wrong. And it's like, I have to believe that if someone is doing something and it's providing them relief, there is some intelligence in that. It may not be the thing that long term want them to do, but you have to, if you acknowledge that, like, you know, that is intel, like, I see why that's bringing, or I can deduce why that would feel good. And let me maybe have them try another thing that might also feel good. And that way they just have more things in their repertoire. You know, like, it's... But at the same time, I still feel like... Like, it's one thing when it's like a restorative workshop, and then, you know, there have been points when restorative workshops that I've given have been big enough where it's been really, really useful to have a second pair of hands. But I just feel like it creates a context where there's way too much information going on. And sometimes it feels like the assistants are, like, circling around like sharks.
Yep.
You know, like...
The buzzards lumbering in between the mats.
Yeah. It's just... And at this point, I don't really... I don't do much hands-on work in the context of a regular group class anyway, so it would be super, super weird to have someone else doing that.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Like,
so, you know... But, you know, the only other thing I'll say about Anna, and then we can move on, is that I feel like if you're going to engage in hands-on work, you have to begin with the understanding that what you're doing is invasive. And the only thing you can do is be less invasive. Like, if I'm going in with the confidence that I know that I'm going to put my hands on somebody and heal them in some way, that's the wrong attitude. Like, your hands express force and attitude, and your, the way that you are in the classroom creates a whole set of relational dynamics with the people that you're putting your hands on. And so, like, you have to go in with the understanding of, no, that, like, I know exactly what I'm going to do. And I know that it is, by definition, invasive. And I'm just going to try and do it in as with as little invasiveness as possible. and you know, get in and get out in the context of a public class. Obviously, you're working with someone one-on-one. The contact may be a little bit longer, I get really hesitant when people start using the word healer. that, like as a noun, that really triggers me.
Yeah.
If you are helping people to heal, that's fine. Hopefully, to some extent, yoga teachers have that intention, that there is a possibility that what you're doing may, in fact, over time, help this person to heal on whatever layer they need to heal. But they are, in fact, doing the healing. Not
I just,
the teacher.
Like, I, you know, it's, there's also just such bravado in it, the yes. word. Like, I alone am a magic touch master magician. I have something special.
And everybody I know that is a brilliantly talented body worker doesn't speak like that.
Yes.
They're just like, yeah, I think I can help with that. Let's see what happens. Like, it's just a very, like, matter-of-fact, honest, like, let me see if I can help. Do you want my help?
Yeah,
great, like, let me see if I can help.
Yeah, like, if you go to a doctor, they're not like, I am a healer.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
They certainly wield other, you know, faux expertise sometimes, but not to that level.
I don't know. So that being said, if you're one of those unique unicorns that's a body worker and a yoga teacher, I have different feelings about hands-on stuff.
But it's still in the context of a classroom, like I don't think it's people aren't signing up for that. Unless they are explicitly signing up for it.
Signing up for that, yeah.
As in, like, that's the description of the workshop, but I mean,
hello?
Yeah, no, I'm here. I'm just thinking.
Oh dear.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying. I don't want to belabor
like
this too
and
much.
I, Alexis Marbach and I taught a workshop, and she is a very trauma sensitive yoga teacher. It's arguably one of the most, if not the most important lens that she views yoga through. And her and I co-taught a workshop together, and we looked at each other and we're like, we're doing hands-on adjusts and assists in this. And we were like, okay, so how do we do this in a, you know, trauma sensitive way? And it was just like all over the description is that. And then we had, you know, the coins so that you could opt out. But so just to be clear, I bring it up not because I'm anti hands-on assists. I just, you know, as long as they're, I had somebody ask me, I'm teaching at a new studio. And, you know, when I did my little, the beginning of the class spiel about injuries and that sort of stuff, somebody called me over and said, you know, I have a back injury. And I talked to them about that. But at the very end, they said, so no assists, please. And it caught me off guard because I wanted to be like, of course not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, you poor thing that you thought you even had to say it. You know?
Yeah.
Don't worry. I don't do those. And she like had sort of like a look of relief. And then I thought to myself, Jesus Christ, what the fuck happened? Like somebody with an injury, she's obviously been to a class where she has gotten hands-on assists that were not wanted.
Yeah.
And
or,
now,
or if not wanted, say, certainly not helpful.
Useful. For, you know. And now she has to go through the energy to tell every fucking teacher, hey, please don't touch me because I'm injured.
Yeah.
So that fun burden is on her now.
Yes.
Anyways. All right. Sharp left turn. Obesity and hypermobility.
Just.
Okay, so this
I love
is.
that you're the one keeping everything on track today. What the fuck is happening?
I'm looking at a baby monitor with a sleeping baby, and I'm just like,
Ah.
how long until the rooster, till the rooster crows. So this is interesting. This is a topic that came up months and months ago, and I don't know why it resurfaced. So can you remind me why it resurfaced for you?
Well, we were talking off microphone last week, and in regards to Dana specifically, and I was commenting on there is both a sort of misconception that I've heard teachers express that there is a distinct link between obesity and hypermobility. And I don't necessarily, I know that that's not really, I know at least enough examples in my experience where of teaching where that's just not true. Because I've seen humans who aren't hypermobile and are larger. So I think that that's a weird conflation that people make sometimes, especially within the context of yoga teaching and even yoga teacher training. But then also, I commented on the fact that the people who really make a name for themselves in the sort of plus-sized yoga sphere, often do so through some very, very impressive shapes. And I think that that's interesting, and not even in the context of talking about size, but any person who is, serves as like the placeholder for some aspect of inclusivity in the yoga world, they usually get to that place by doing impressive shapes. Like that's still the currency, even though they don't look like a typical, stereotypical yoga person, that's still the currency, and that's a problem.
Oh, thank God. Thank God we're talking about this. Okay, so the
I'm
price to
not.
ride the roller coaster.
I'm just curious. I'm not off base in that thing that I've heard, the sort of false equivalency.
Okay,
You've
there's
heard that
two
as
things
well.
I want to, yeah, there's two things I want to address. I have absolutely heard both. Well, A, I've noticed that in the body positive community, the people that are doing the most on Instagram are the people with the largest ranges of motion in a large body. I have also heard, that larger people tend to have lax ligaments because they're carrying so much weight, which is a falsehood. Now, the way I think the reason that people might think that is because if they're in a yoga classroom, a public classroom, and they see a larger body in the room, I can tell you that it takes an awful lot to get in a large body into a public yoga classroom. It just takes
Absolutely.
a lot. And so for the people that you're seeing might be the people that are like, hey, I'm fat and I don't belong in the yoga class in this way. I'm getting that messaging loud and clear. I can pass because look at my range of motion. So what the first people that feel sort of somewhat free to experiment with yoga or to join the conversation are the people that are former dancers or the people that are naturally super mobile. They're like, oh, look, I can do this crazy split thing, so I can at least do that when I get there. Now, the people that are like that are obese but very stiff that come in might feel like they've got two mountains. They've got at least two mountains to climb. And I fall in that camp. When I started, I was much heavier and I was super stiff. Like super stiff. So I get it. And I think you're right that it's a big fucking problem, because now the messaging for larger bodies is, you better get here.
Yeah.
It's not inspirational to me. It's like, oh, look, a larger body doing something cool. Okay, that's cool. But aren't I allowed to be a larger body that just like has a practice that makes me feel good in my body and isn't like.
Yes. Yeah. That's.
Doing crazy shit.
And I just, you know,
isn't that enough? Can't I just be enough?
If we're going to have a talk, you know, generally about more in inclusivity in the yoga classroom on any aspect of everything that could include, you know, including race, including gender, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It would be awful if the price of admission is, okay, we accept you, but you got to be able to do that. Or you can feel comfortable here if you can bend over and touch the floor. Like, you know what it is, like if we're getting to inclusivity and then also being horribly ableist in the track there, it's questionable to me. And you know, that's not to say that, because I've never taken a class, with Dana or Jessamine or any of the, I'm forgetting someone else's name that I don't know why it's not coming to the top of my brain right now. But it could very well be that those big, you know, complex shapes that they're doing on Instagram, it could very well be that they're not teaching those in class, that they're just teaching a really good yoga class, and when people come into the room, it's accessible to whatever body at whatever skill level is present in room that day.
Yes.
But I have to wonder if we're still preference, if there's still the what is the word that I'm looking for, the like supremacy of the deep range of motion yoga pose. It's just like, it's just a fine line, I think.
There are plus size yogis out there, doing just that. Like,
totally.
There's somebody in Boston. It's called Mortal Love Yoga, and
yes, and
the culture of that is definitely just like accessibility. Yeah. Like, yeah,
yeah,
let's do tree pose together. You know, like it's just like a little bit kinder, and I do think, though, it's interesting. Like, you're not going to see as many ambassadorships
going to that.
And full circle, let's tie it right back in. And that's what's so fucked up, man. Like, the people that we're going to hear from through the corporate amplifier is going to be the people with crazy ranges of motion.
Yes, absolutely.
But I will say, if the people that come to your class that are in larger bodies happen to be hypermobile, just know it's because those people self-select. They know that they're welcome in a different way. They're less terrified of being in a yoga class because at least they come in, quote unquote, at least they come in being able to put their bodies in these shapes.
Yeah.
You know, even if they're new. Like,
but honestly, and I think the tough like pedagogical part of this conversation is that what most people are coming to yoga for, someone, regardless of size, who experiences great deal of hypermobility, it's not that they can't use a lot of their range of motion. It's just the action that might be beneficial within that range of motion is going to be very different than what I'm, like, this is happening on in the Thursday night series here.
That we have some students who are hypermobile, and it's like, okay, I need, trying to figure out how it's like, okay, except you do the opposite. Like you engage more instead of try to lengthen. Like it's a hard thing, like just talking about hypermobility in general, because a great deal of people who come and find benefit through yoga class on the physical level, like I require going in and pulling traction on my joints in order to feel, because they are just compressed at all times. And that is not something that everybody needs all the time. It's not something that I need all the time, but a good percentage of the time I need it. So, you know, when I start thinking about hypermobility more generally, I quickly get into this place of like, this is why I only want like 3 people in my class ever. So I could actually, if needed, teach 3 entirely separate classes to the 3 people in the room. Because that's about the most people that I can actually achieve that with. You know, whenever there's been, you know, a group of a small classroom where everyone is needing something slightly different, I can keep my eye on 3 people, no more than that. Then above that, it has to get more like, okay, we're going to do this as a group now. So I don't know. I just think the whole thing is, made even more interesting too, because then when you talk about the other aspects of the yoga practice, it's like, part of the reason why there's that dichotomy is because so much is placed on the physical. Instead of spending time building a simple awareness practice where we could have a conversation about what the meaning of sensation is and how to address those sensations and then build the poses on top of that so that there's already an awareness of the actions that are necessary to either stabilize or lengthen. And then there can be a multitude of choices that people are making in their bodies based on the sensations that they are feeling. But how you do that, I mean, you basically just have to kind of throw the whole context of the yoga class out the window a little bit. Like, I don't know how to do that in a basic drop-in class.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know how to do it outside of a one-on-one setting, to be perfectly honest. So, that's my shtick.
Oh, all right. Sharp left turn.
Kick out.
We're rounding home. Dietary stuff. Okay. Full disclosure.
Yes.
My brother and I once in a while get a wild hair across our ass to do something.
Okay.
Once it was running a 5K, which turned to us getting drunk one night and saying, this is for a marathon. I've since been sober for 6 years, but and we looked at each other and were like, let's do it. We can do it. We're only living once. Let's live. So we did it. And me and my brother and my sister and my uncle, we ran that marathon together. And went on to run several more. But once in a while, we get these things, and the thing that he got across his ass is he wants to do Whole 30. You know what Whole 30 is? All right, it's 30 days of no sugar, no flour, nothing processed pretty much in any way. There's a bunch of other rules too. No beans, no peanut butter. It's basically just like veggies and meat.
Why no beans?
I don't know. That one's the weird one.
That seems odd to me.
It's basically an elimination diet to see what your body is actually, how your body's actually responding to groups of foods. So it's 30 days of that. and he wants to do that. And so I looked into it and poked around, and honestly, it didn't feel quite right for me.
Yeah.
And I was like, but I don't shirk at a challenge, and I like the idea of doing something for 30 days because I appreciate experimentation.
Yes.
And I appreciate hitting the reset button.
Yes.
And questioning my connections and attachments. So I looked around, and then I discovered this thing called Bright Line Eating, which many people might know about, but it's basically, and we could do a whole freaking podcast on how problematic this is. Basically, I forget what degree she is. She has her PhD in like behavioral neuropsychology or something totally legit. And she is a recovering addict that followed Food Addicts Anonymous plan, which mm-hmm. It's free, Ryan. It's free. And it's like AA, but for food. And the rules are 3 meals a day, no sugar, no flour, measure and weigh your food. And it's for food addicts. And she took that plan, essentially, made some minor tweaks to it, and has now wrote a New York Times best-selling book about it, and does online boot camps, and is selling it for a lot of fucking money as a cure, as being one of the only cures for obesity.
Okay.
And I find it to be super captivating because she's got science to back it, and like nobody else. That's one of the reasons why the size positive movement is so fucking important, because science has there is not one study that shows a program or a pill or a surgery or a procedure that people lose weight and keep it off.
Mm-hmm.
That's breathtaking. So people that are getting gastric bypass, statistically, the chances of them gaining it back are well above 90%.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing. There's nothing. So, but this program, because it's like a complete reframe, and it's essentially just AA, but for eating, it's interesting, and I'm intrigued by it. So I'm thinking of experimenting with that, because I am intrigued with my relationship with flour and sugar right now.
When people say no sugar, you can't. It's impossible. What do you mean by no sugar?
So what they mean by no sugar is like no refined white sugar, obviously. No.
They mean no fruits?
No, I'm getting there. Okay. No honey, no maple syrup. Fruits you can have, but I believe you're supposed to have them with a meal, so it shouldn't be like just fruit.
Okay.
Because that'll turn to sugar faster. So it's not, I mean, obviously most sugars, like, it turns into carbs, you know, but the idea is sugar, refined sugar, and flour. And the science that she got me on is, she's like, it's more addicting than cocaine. And she talked about the imaging they've done on brains on these foods and the brains of addicts. And I'm like, well, I know for sure I'm an addict. Why then wouldn't I also be addicted to sugar and flour? So while it's against my personal politics to diet,
sure,
I'm trying not to think of this as a diet, and I'm thinking of this as more in line with sobriety.
Okay. I mean, I think all of this is fine as long as it's an experiment. Like, anything that you do with food, like, or with substance for that matter, like, you're trying something and you see how it feels. And the second it goes from trying something and see how it feels to and then it feeling good potentially, and then you keep going with it because, like, oh, this is actually a better way to like function, is to not have sugar or not have this or that, then like Yeah, I just, I don't know. There's something in me that has like a history of being very restrictive with food. So anytime that I'm restrictive with anything, it's a little problematic.
I completely hear you.
And also like I think sometimes I think sometimes these things go like a little too far, like to have a bit of maple syrup. That's not gonna kill you.
It's not going to kill you, but it does set off a chain reaction for an addict. Like for me, like I can totally understand the lens they're looking at this through, because like every question I have had about this program is like, well, why can't I have a piece of birthday cake on my birthday? And I'm like, oh my God, I said the exact same thing about drinking. Oh my God, I can't have a glass of champagne at my wedding. And it's like, once you're in recovery, you don't care, because what you gained by giving that up is so much greater than like having a glass of fucking champagne. You don't give a shit about it. But I'm like having the same response to sugar, but it's different. That's the thing. Like at the end of the day, food and alcohol are different.
And also,
But there's a lure to compartmentalizing it in the same way.
And also, I don't know that it also, I mean, if one were to cut out processed sugar crap, like that makes sense to me, but you know, sweet is something that your body can have. And in fact, you know, if you look at it from an Ayurvedic lens, someone like me who is pitta to the extreme, like it does make a big difference in my digestion if I like, I don't want in the morning, like if I make myself oatmeal, I don't want to put maple syrup in it. Like that does not taste good to me at all. But if I put it in, it does just a little bit. It does jumpstart my like hunger cycle a little bit better. Because if I forget to eat anything in the
Yeah, because
morning,
this
then I
gets your
just
insulin going.
but that's supposed to happen.
Yeah, for you, but for somebody like me, that's like not good.
Well, exactly, but that's what Ayurveda would say, is that you know, everyone's constitution is very different, and your gut is very different than mine, and so like whenever there's something that's like even moderately one size fits all when it comes to diet,
Yes, you're right.
there's a big red flag that goes up for
Yeah,
me.
I think you're right. I think probably the assumption is the people that get to that point are probably all sharing a similar profile. But I hear you. And so if I do decide to embark on this, it is going to be in the spirit of experimentation, because I have a massive problem with that's not true. I have a big radar for yoga teachers talking about nutrition when they're not
Yeah, when they're
nutritionists
not a
and talking about
nutritionist.
lifestyle. There's an exception though. I have a buddy of mine, Meg, is going to teach a workshop on including more meat-free food in your life. And it's not for a political reason. It's not for the animals. It's not for weight. It's like, hey, are you curious about what it might look like to dance a little with vegetarianism and veganism? And she's doing it with somebody that's a plant nutritionist coach, and they're doing the workshop together. And like, it's literally the ideal way to do that kind of thing if you're going to do that kind of thing. And I'm really excited for them. I might even take it because I'm intrigued to see this go out, because I've seen so many of them come across as so shitty. Like so shame inducing, and like, here's how to do the here's the one way for you to eat clean, you filthy animal. you know, and but like Meg's got a sense of humor. Meg loves burgers, you know, yeah. And you know, she's just going to talk about her journey and what's interesting to her right now. And she's there with an expert who's going to talk about their perspective. And it seems really fucking cool.
Yeah.
But in general, yoga and lifestyle stuff to me is, is interesting.
Yeah. But I think there is a, so if yoga is supposed to be about our direct experience, that includes what we're putting into our bodies and how we experience that is worth exploring as part of a broader practice. Now, the second that someone starts, like there's a difference between reading about, you know, vegetarianism from the purely like, this is how plants go into your body and this is how meat goes into your body, like, and if you read about that and then decide that you're either going to become a vegetarian or cut way back on the amount of meat that you're having and see how it feels, then that's great, as long as they're the like, there is the like, let me be clear about the reasoning why I'm doing this, and to, you know that it will always be a, I think for most people, it's not like you flip a switch and then you've become a vegetarian forever, you become a vegan forever. There's always some ebb and flow just based on what your, body, needs. And, you know, I have had friends who like haven't eaten, meat for years and then have had medical issues where the doctors were like, okay, so we're really supportive of you being a vegetarian, but I'm going to need you to eat meat because it will just either to quickly gain weight if weight loss is becoming an issue and difficult to keep on as a vegetarian. Or I had one friend who, because iron levels were so low, the doctor was like, just maybe have like start incorporating a little bit more, more meat into your diet. Not forever, just, you know, for a short term, period. So I think it always has to be this very delicate dance of like, okay, so I'm vegetarian or I'm vegan. If vegetarianism or veganism is causing you in any way to suffer, like actually suffer, then you got to think about something else, right? But if it's actually causing you to thrive, then that's great. But it's the outcome focus that is interesting to me. And if it doesn't seem to affect you either way, and you still decide to be vegetarian because of political ecological, environmental reasons, then great. Those are your reasons. But I think it's important to like actually have the acknowledgement that like, okay, so I don't actually feel all that different one versus the other, or I do feel really different one versus the other, and I think we should eat less meat because of, you know, the environment, then great. So that's my two cents on the issue.
Yeah, and to throw in my remaining two cents that's left in my wallet, as long as you're not shaming anybody else.
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
Because motherfucking fucker, if I hear one more time, you know, like, it's dietary choices, like traveling choices, have everything to do with class, have everything to do with money and resources and time. Yeah. And if you try to tell me different, I'm going to set myself on fire. And that's not going to hurt you, but you're going to have some dreams about it.
Yeah.
You know? Tell me I'm wrong. I'd love to hear it. Yeah, that's a good reminder. We've said a lot of inflammatory things. If we've inflamed you, please let's start a conversation. If you want to send us an email, or I don't know.
You can email us at unrolledpodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Instagram at unrolledpodcast. I also started a Twitter.
Ryan, for us. Did you? God damn it.
I did. I'm experimenting with Twitter as a replacement for looking at Facebook. Acknowledging that there's very interesting articles and news that sometimes come across my Facebook feed, but wanting to get that maybe with less of the Facebookness of it all. It's a grand experiment. We'll see how it works. So Kate and I are going to go down to doing two podcasts per month, and we will be setting up within the Patreon page, if you'd like to donate and support, setting tiers so that if we get to one amount that gets us to two podcasts per month, where we not only get to pay all of our expenses, but we also get to pay ourselves for doing the podcast, which would be super exciting. And then another level at which, if we reach that, where we'll add a third podcast in each month, and also get to cover our expenses and pay for ourselves. Another tier where we would go back to doing a podcast each week and continue to cover our expenses and pay ourselves for our time. I'll be emailing everybody who's been supporting us on Patreon with once that information is all up, and you can always find that page by just going to unrolledpodcast.com and clicking the link at the top of the screen. I think that's everything. Did I miss anything, Kate?
I don't think so.
Okay. Have a wonderful day, evening, morning, whenever it is that you tend to listen to this. And we will be back next week.
Sweet.
Bye.